to express his emotions and had had no access to tenderness ever since his relationship with Clara had deteriorated, transferred all his finest sentiments to Alba. The child meant more to him than his own children ever had. Every morning, still in her pajamas, she went to her grandfather's room. She entered without knocking and climbed into his bed. He would pretend to wake up with a start, even though he was actually expecting her, and growled that she should not disturb him and that she should go back to her room and let him sleep. Alba tickled him until, apparently defeated, he permitted her to look for the chocolate he always had hidden for her. Alba knew all his hiding places, and her grandfather always used them in the exact same order. But so as not to disappoint him, she spent a long time looking, and when she found it, she shrieked with joy. Esteban never knew that his granddaughter hated chocolate, and that she ate it only out of love for him. Those morning games satisfied the senator's need for human contact. The rest of the day, he was busy with the Congress, the club, playing golf, his business, and his political meetings. Twice a year, he went to Tres Marias with his granddaughter for 2 or 3 weeks. They both returned looking tanned, happier, and fatter. There they distilled a homemade brandy that was used as a drink to light the stove, to disinfect wounds, and to kill cockroaches. They pompously called it vodka. At the end of his life, when his 90 years had turned him into a twisted, fragile tree, Esteban Trueba would recall those moments with his granddaughter as the happiest of his whole existence. Alba, too, remembered the complicity of those trips to the country, holding on to her grandfather's hand, the jaunts behind him in the saddle of his horse, the sunsets in the vast pastures, the long nights beside the living room fireplace telling ghost stories and drawing pictures. Senator Trueba's relationship with the rest of his family only worsened with time. Once a week, on Saturday, they all dined around the great oak table that had always been in the family and had first belonged to the Del Valles. It was the most ancient of antiques and had been used for laying out the dead, for Spanish dances, and for other unexpected needs. Alba was seated between her grandmother and mother, with a cushion on her chair so that her nose would reach her plate. The child watched the adults in fascination. There was her radiant grandmother, her teeth in place for the occasion, sending messages to her husband through her children or the servants. Jaime, flaunting his bad manners by burping after each course and picking his teeth with his little finger to annoy his father. Nicolás, with his eyes half closed, chewing every bite 50 times. And Blanca, chattering about anything she could think of just to create the illusion of a normal meal. Trueba remained relatively silent until his bad temper betrayed him and he began to argue with Jaime about the poor, the elections, the socialists, and basic principles. Or to insult Nicolás for his attempts to launch a balloon and practice acupuncture on Alba. Or to punish Blanca with his harsh replies, his indifference, and his useless warnings that she had already ruined her life and that she would never inherit so much as a peso from him. The only one he did not confront was Clara. But, of course, he barely spoke to her. At times, Alba caught her grandfather staring at Clara, until he turned white and sweet, and looked like an old man they had never seen before. But this happened only rarely. Typically, husband and wife ignored each other. Sometimes, Senator Trueba lost his temper and screamed so much that he turned red, and they had to throw a jug full of cold water in his face so that the fit would pass, and his breathing would return to normal. This was the period when Blanca's beauty was at its peak. She had a Moorish, languid, and abundant air about her, which induced repose and trust. She was tall and well-endowed, of a rather helpless and tearful temperament that roused men's ancestral instinct for protection. Her father had no sympathy for her. He never forgave her love for Pedro III García, and made sure she did not forget that she was living off his pity. Trueba could not understand how his daughter had so many admirers, for she had none of the disarming gaiety and joviality he liked in women. Besides, he felt that no normal man could want to marry a woman of ill health and uncertain civil status who already had a daughter. But Blanca did not seem the least surprised that men were interested in her. She was conscious of her beauty. Nevertheless, when she was with the gentlemen who called on her, she assumed a contradictory attitude, encouraging them with a batting of her Arabian eyes, but keeping them at a prudent distance. As soon as she saw that their intentions were serious, she broke off the relationship with a ferocious refusal. Some of them, those in a better economic position, attempted to win her heart by bribing her daughter. They showered Alba with expensive gifts and dolls with special mechanisms that enabled them to walk, cry, eat, and carry out other typically human feats, stuffed her with cream puffs, and took her to the zoo, where the child wept with pity for the poor captive animals, especially the seal, who stirred dreadful omens in her soul. These visits to the zoo, holding on to the hand of some conceited spendthrift suitor, gave her a lifelong horror of enclosures, walls, cages, and isolation. Of all the contenders, the one who made the greatest progress toward winning Blanca's hand was the king of the pressure cookers. Despite his immense fortune and his peaceful, introspective character, Esteban Trueba detested him because he was circumcised and had a Sephardic nose and kinky hair. With his mocking, hostile attitude, Trueba managed to frighten off this man who had survived a concentration camp, overcome poverty and exile, and triumphed in the ruthless world of commerce. While their romance lasted, the king of the pressure cookers would come to call for Blanca and take her out to eat in the most exclusive restaurants. He drove a tiny car with only two seats, tractor tires, and the noise of a turbine under the hood, a unique model in its class, which provoked a rush of curiosity among the neighbors and derogatory remarks from the Trueba family. Ignoring her father's displeasure and the neighbor's nosy interest, Blanca would climb up into the vehicle with the majesty of a prime minister, dressed in her one and only black tailored suit and the white silk blouse she wore on all special occasions. Alba would kiss her goodbye and stand in the doorway, her mother's subtle jasmine perfume clinging to her nostrils and a knot of anxiety lying in her heart. Only her uncle Nicolás's training helped her withstand her mother's outings without tears, because she feared that any day one of the suitors would convince her mother to marry him, and Blanca would leave her all alone without a mother. She had decided a long time ago that she did not need a father, much less a stepfather, but that if she lost her mother, she would plunge her head into a pail of water until she drowned, just as the cook did with the little kittens the cat gave birth to every 4 months or so. Alba got over her fear that her mother would abandon her when she finally met Pedro III. Her intuition told her that as long as that man existed, no one could win Blanca's love. It was a summer Sunday. Blanca set Alba's hair in corkscrew curls with a hot iron that singed her ears. She dressed her in white gloves and black patent leather shoes and a straw hat with artificial cherries. Her grandmother Clara laughed aloud when she caught sight of her, but her mother consoled her with two drops of her perfume on her neck. "You're gonna meet someone famous," Blanca said mysteriously as they left the house. She took the child to the Japanese gardens, where she bought her caramel on a stick and a bag of popcorn. They sat down on a bench in the shade, holding hands, surrounded by pigeons that were pecking at the corn. She saw him approaching before her mother pointed him out to her. He was wearing a mechanic's overalls and Franciscan sandals without socks, and he had a huge black beard that reached halfway down his chest. His hair was messy, but he had a magnificent smile, which immediately ranked him in the category of human beings who deserve to be painted into the gigantic fresco in her bedroom. The man and the little girl looked at each other, recognizing themselves in the other's eyes. "This is Pedro III, the singer," You heard him on the radio, her mother said. Alba held out her hand, and he squeezed it with his left one. Then she noticed that he was missing several fingers on his right hand, but he explained that he could play the guitar anyway, because there is always a way to do what you want to do. The three of them strolled together through the Japanese gardens. In mid-afternoon, they took one of the last electric streetcars that still existed in the city and went to have fried fish at a stall in the market. At dusk, he escorted them as far as their street. When they said goodbye, Blanca and Pedro III kissed each other on the mouth. It was the first time Alba had seen that in her life, because no one around her was in love. From that day on, Blanca began going out alone every weekend. She said she was going to visit some distant cousins. Esteban Trueba got furious with her and threatened to expel her from his house. But Blanca was unyielding. She left her daughter with Clara and took the bus, carrying a clown's valise covered with flowers. "I promise you I'm not getting married and that I'll be back tomorrow night," she would say to Alba when she said goodbye. Alba liked to sit with the cook at siesta time, listening to popular singing on the radio, especially the songs of the man she had met in the Japanese gardens. One day, Senator Trueba entered the pantry, and when he heard the voice on the radio, he attacked the machine, smashing it with his cane until it was a pile of twisted wires and loose knobs, before the frightened eyes of his granddaughter, who could not understand her grandfather's sudden fit. The next day, Clara bought another radio so Alba could listen to Pedro III whenever she felt like it, and old Trueba pretended not to notice. That was still the era of the king of the pressure cookers. Pedro III found out about his existence and had an attack of jealousy that was unwarranted if one compares the influence he had on Blanca with the timid siege of the Jewish merchant. As he had so many other times, he begged Blanca to leave the Trueba house, her father's ferocious guardianship, and the loneliness of her workshop filled with mongoloids and leisured ladies, and to go with him once and for all to live out the wild love they had been hiding ever since their childhood. But Blanca could not make up her mind. She knew that if she went with Pedro III, she would be banished from her social circle and from the position she had always had, and she also realized that she would never be accepted by Pedro III's friends or be able to adjust to the modest life of a working-class quarter. Years later, when Alba was old enough to analyze this aspect of her mother's life, she concluded that she had not gone with Pedro III simply because she did not love him enough, for there was nothing in the Trueba house that he could not have given her. Blanca was a very poor woman. She had money only when Clara gave her some, or when she sold one of her crushes. She earned a wretched income, almost every cent of which she spent on doctors because work and necessity had not diminished her capacity for suffering imaginary illnesses. On the contrary, it seemed to be expanding year by year. She managed not to ask her father for anything, so as not to give him the least opportunity to humiliate her. From time to time, Clara and Jaime bought her clothes or gave her something for her basic needs, but usually she could not afford to buy a pair of stockings. Her poverty contrasted with the embroidered dresses and custom-made shoes in which Senator Trueba dressed his granddaughter Alba. Her life was hard. She rose at 6 every morning, winter and summer. Then, dressed in a rubber apron and wooden clogs, she lit her kiln, prepared her work tables, and pounded the clay for her classes, her arms up to her elbows in the coarse, cold mud. This was why she always had broken nails and cracked skin, and why, with time, her fingers grew deformed. At that time of the day, she felt inspired, and since there was no one to interrupt her, she could start her day by making extraordinary animals for her creches. Afterward, she had to see to the house, the servants, and the shopping until her classes began. Her pupils were daughters of the best families who had nothing to do and had taken up the fashion of ceramics, which was more elegant than knitting for the poor, as their grandmothers had done. The idea of giving classes for Mongoloids had come about by chance. One day, an old friend of Clara's came to Senator Trueba's house with her grandson, a fat, soft teenager, with the round face of a docile moon and an expression of unchanging tenderness in his tiny, oriental eyes. He was 15, but Alba realized he was like a baby. Clara asked her granddaughter to take the boy out to play in the garden and make sure he did not soil his clothes, drown in the fountain, eat dirt, or play with his fly. Alba quickly tired of watching him, and when she saw it was impossible to communicate with him in any coherent language, she took him to the ceramic studio, where Blanca, to keep him amused, tied an apron around him to protect him from stains and water, and placed a ball of clay in his hands. The boy played with it for more than 3 hours, shaping a number of crude figures that he took to show his grandmother. This lady, who had practically forgotten he was with her, was utterly delighted. Thus, the idea was born that ceramics was good for Mongoloids. Blanca ended up giving classes to a group of children who came to her studio every Thursday afternoon. They were delivered by truck and escorted by two nuns in starched white coifs who sat in the garden drinking chocolate with Clara and discussing the virtues of cross-stitching and the hierarchy of sin, while Blanca and her daughter taught the children how to fashion worms, balls, squash dogs, and misshapen vases. At the end of the year, the nuns organized an exhibition and a party, and the dreadful works of art were sold for charity. Blanca and Alba had quickly understood that the children worked much better when they felt loved, and that the only way to communicate with them was through affection. They learned to hug them, kiss them, and fondle them until they wound up genuinely loving them. Alba waited all week for the truck with the retarded children to come, and she jumped with glee when they ran to hug her. But those Thursdays wore them out. Alba fell asleep exhausted, the sweet, Asiatic faces of the children spinning in her mind, and Blanca invariably had a migraine. After the nuns left, their herd of Mongoloids in hand and their white wings aflutter, Blanca hugged her daughter passionately, covered her face with kisses, and told her they should thank God that she was normal. For this reason, Alba grew up thinking that normality was a gift from heaven. She discussed it with her grandmother.
In almost every family, there's a fool or a crazy person,
Clara assured her while she concentrated on her knitting. In all those years, she had not learned to knit without looking.
You can't always see them because they're kept out of sight as if they were something to be ashamed of. They're locked up in the back room so visitors won't see them. But actually, there's nothing to be ashamed of. They're God's creatures, too.
But there's no one like that in our family, Grandmother, Alba replied.
No, here the madness was divided up equally, and there was nothing left over for us to have our own lunatic.
This was how her conversations with Clara went, and why, for Alba, the most important person in the house and the strongest presence in her life was her grandmother. She was the motor that drove the magic universe that was the rear section of the house on the corner, where Alba spent her first 7 years in complete freedom. She grew accustomed to her grandmother's eccentricities. She was not surprised, for example, to see her moving around the room in a trance, seated in an armchair with her legs tucked under her, pulled by an invisible force. She followed her on her pilgrimages to hospitals and almshouses, where Clara tried to track down her needy flock. She even learned using four-ply wool and enormous needles to knit the sweaters her Uncle Jaime gave away after he had worn them once, just so she could see her grandmother's toothless smile while she squinted at the stitches. Clara frequently used her to send messages to Esteban, which earned her the nickname Carrier Pigeon. This little girl also took part in the Friday sessions, during which the three-legged table jumped in broad daylight without the aid of any special tricks, known form of energy, or outside leverage,
as well as the literary soirees where she mingled with the acclaimed masters and a varying group of timid unknown artists whom Clara encouraged. In those days, a large number of guests ate and drank in the big house on the corner. Almost all the most important people in the country took turns living there, or at least attending the spiritualist meetings, the cultural discussions, and the social gatherings. Among them was the poet, years later considered the greatest of the century and translated into all the known languages on earth, on whose knees Alba often sat, little suspecting that one day she would walk behind his casket with a bunch of bloody carnations in her hand between two rows of machine guns. Clara was still young, but to her granddaughter, she looked very old because of her missing teeth. She had no wrinkles, and when her mouth was closed, she gave the impression of extreme youth because of the innocent look on her face. She wore tunics of raw linen that looked like the robes crazy people wear, and in the winter she wore long woolen socks and fingerless gloves. She laughed at things that were not the least bit funny. On the other hand, she was incapable of understanding any joke, always laughing at the wrong time, and she could become very sad if she saw someone else behaving in a ridiculous fashion. Sometimes she had asthma attacks and would summon her granddaughter with a tiny silver bell she always carried on her person. Alba would come running to embrace her with consoling whispers, since they both knew from long experience that the only cure for asthma is the prolonged embrace of a loved one. She had laughing hazel eyes, shiny hair flecked with white, and pulled into an untidy bun from which rebellious wisps escaped, and fine white hands with almond-shaped nails and long ringless fingers, which were useless except when it came to gestures of affection, arranging her divining cards or putting in her denture before meals. Alba spent the day trailing after her, snuggling into her skirts and begging her to tell one of her stories or move the vases with the power of her mind. She found in her grandmother a sure refuge when she was haunted by nightmares or when her uncle Nicolás's training became unbearable. Clara taught her how to take care of birds and speak to each of them in its own language, as well as how to read the premonitions in nature and knit chain stitch scarves for the poor. Alba knew that her grandmother was the soul of the big house on the corner. Everybody else learned it later, when Clara died and the house lost its flowers, its nomadic friends, and its playful spirits, and entered into an era of decline. Alba was 6 years old the first time she saw Esteban Garcia, but she never forgot him. She had probably seen him before at Tres Marias, on one of her summer journeys with her grandfather. Old Trueba liked to take her out to see the property and, with a sweeping gesture that took in everything in sight, from the meadows to the volcano to the little brick houses, tell her that she must learn to love this land because one day it would be hers. "My children are all fools. If they inherited Tres Marias in less than a year, it would be a ruin again, just as in my father's day," he told his granddaughter.
"All this is yours, grandfather?"
"Every bit of it. From the Pan American Highway to those mountaintops over there. You see them?"
"Why, grandfather?"
"What do you mean, why?" "Because I'm the owner."
"But why are you the owner?"
"Because it belonged to my family."
"Why?"
"Because they bought it from the Indians."
"And what about the tenants who've always lived here? Why aren't they the owners, too?"
"Your Uncle Jaime is putting Bolshevik ideas into your head," Senator Trueba would roar, sputtering with rage.
"Do you know what would happen here without a patron?"
"No."
"The place would go to hell. There would be no one to give orders, sell the crops, take responsibility for things, you understand? No one to take care of people, either. If anyone got sick or died or left a widow with a lot of kids, they'd all starve to death. Everyone would have a little piece of land that wouldn't produce enough for them to eat. They need someone to do their thinking for them. Someone around to make decisions. Someone to help them. I've been the best patron around, Alba. I may have a bad temper, but I'm fair. My tenants live better than a lot of people in the city. They lack for nothing. And even when there's a drought or a flood or an earthquake, I see to it that no one suffers here. And that's exactly what you'll have to do when you're old enough. That's why I bring you to Tres Marias, so that you'll learn to know each stone and each animal and, above all, each person by their first and last name. Do you understand? But in fact, she had very little contact with the peasants and was far from knowing each of them by name. This was why she failed to recognize the swarthy, awkward, slow-moving young man with the cruel eyes of a rodent who knocked one afternoon at the door of the big house on the corner. He was wearing a dark suit that was much too tight for him. The cloth was worn to a shiny film on his knees, elbows, and behind. He said he wanted to speak to Senator Trueba and introduced himself as the son of one of the tenants from Tres Marias. Despite the fact that in normal times, people of his condition entered through the service entrance and waited in the pantry, he was shown to the library, because that day there was a banquet in the house that was to be attended by the whole directorate of the Conservative Party. The kitchen had been invaded by an army of cooks and their helpers, whom Trueba had borrowed from the club, and there was such confusion and pressure that a visitor would have got in the way. It was a winter afternoon, and the library was dark and silent, lit only by the fire that was dancing in the chimney. It smelled of furniture polish and leather. "Wait here, but don't touch anything. The senator will be in shortly," the maid said brusquely, leaving him alone. The young man ran his eyes over the room, without daring to make the slightest movement, simmering with resentment at the thought that all this might have belonged to him if only he had been legitimate. His grandmother, Pancha Garcia, had explained it to him many times before she had died of chicken fever and left him a true orphan in that crowd of brothers and cousins where he was nobody. Only his grandmother had paid him any attention, and she never let him forget that he was different from the others because the patron's blood ran in his veins. He felt suffocated as he looked around the library. The walls were covered with shelves of polished mahogany, except on either side of the fireplace, where there were two glass cases filled with marble and hard stones from the Orient. The room was two stories high, the only whim of the architect that Esteban Trueba had consented to. A balcony, to which one ascended via a spiral staircase made of wrought iron, took the place of the second story of shelves. This was where the finest paintings in the house were kept, for Esteban Trueba had made this his refuge, his office, his sanctuary, and he liked to have his most cherished objects close beside him. The shelves were filled from floor to ceiling with books and objets d'art. There was a heavy Spanish-style desk, huge black leather armchairs with their backs to the window, four Persian carpets on the oak parquet, and several reading lamps with parchment shades strategically placed so that no matter where one sat, there would always be good light for reading. This was where the senator preferred to hold his meetings, weave his intrigues, forge his deals, and in his lonely hours, closet himself to release his rage, his frustrated desire, or his sorrow. But none of this was known to the peasant standing on the carpet, unsure of where to put his hands and perspiring heavily. That majestic, heavy, crushing library was exactly like the image he had of the patron. He shuddered with hate and fear. He had never been in such a place, and until this moment, he had thought that the most luxurious spot imaginable was the movie house in San Lucas, where the school teacher had once taken the whole class to see a Tarzan movie. It had not been easy for him to arrive at this decision, to convince his family, and to make the long trip to the capital alone and without a centavo to speak with the patron. He could not wait till summer to tell him what was lodged in his chest. Suddenly he felt he was being watched. He turned around and found himself face to face with a little girl with braids and embroidered socks who was staring at him from the doorway.
"What's your name?"
she asked.
"Esteban Garcia," he replied.
"Mine is Alba Trueba. Will you remember my name?"
"I will."
They stared at each other a long time, until she began to trust him and came forward. She explained that he would have to wait, because her grandfather had still not returned from Congress, and she told him that there was a mob of people in the kitchen on account of the party, and promised him that later on she would bring him some sweets. Esteban Garcia felt more comfortable. He sat down in one of the black leather armchairs, and little by little, drew the child toward him and sat her on his knees. Alba smelled of bay rum, a sweet, fresh scent that mingled with the natural smell of sweaty little girl. The boy put his nose against her neck and inhaled that unknown perfume of cleanliness and well-being. Without knowing why, his eyes filled with tears. He felt that he hated this little girl almost as much as he did old Trueba. She embodied everything he would never have, never be. He wanted to hurt her, destroy her. But he also wanted to continue smelling her, listening to her baby's voice, and having her soft skin within reach of his hand. He stroked her knees, just above the border of her embroidered socks. They were warm and had little dimples. Alba continued chattering about the cook, who had stuck walnuts up the chicken's tail for the evening meal. He closed his eyes. He was shaking. With one hand, he encircled the child's neck. He felt the tickle of her braids against his wrist and squeezed ever so gently, aware that she was so tiny he could strangle her with very little effort. He wanted to do it, feel her writhing and kicking at his knees, squirming as she fought for air. He wanted to hear her moan and die in his arms. He wanted to pull off her clothes. He felt violently aroused. With his other hand, he ventured beneath her well-starched dress, running his fingers up her child's legs until he found the lace of her batiste petticoats and her woolen drawers with their elastic bands. He was panting. In a corner of his brain, he had just enough sanity left to realize that he was poised on the edge of a bottomless pit. The child had stopped talking and was very still, staring up at him with her huge black eyes. Esteban Garcia took her hand and placed it on his stiffened sex.
"Do you know what this is?"
he asked hoarsely.
"Your penis," she replied.
For she had seen it in the illustrations of her Uncle Jaime's medical books, and on her Uncle Nicolas whenever he walked around naked doing his oriental exercises. He jumped. He stood up suddenly, and she fell to the carpet. He was surprised and frightened. His hands were shaking, his knees had become weak, and his ears were burning. Just then, he heard Senator Trueba's footsteps in the hallway, and seconds later, before he could catch his breath, the old man walked into the library.
"Why is it so dark in here?"
he roared in his earthquake of a voice.
Trueba turned on the lights and seemed not to recognize the young man who was staring wild-eyed at him. He stretched his arms out to his granddaughter, and she ran to him for cover for a moment, like a whipped puppy. But she quickly pried herself free and ran out, shutting the door behind her.
"Who are you, man?"
he spat at the one who was also his grandchild.
"Esteban Garcia. Don't you remember me, patron?"
the other managed to stammer. Then Trueba recognized the crafty little boy who had betrayed Pedro III years before and who had retrieved his amputated fingers. He understood that it would not be easy to send him away without giving him a hearing, despite the fact that, as a rule, matters concerning his tenants were supposed to be resolved by the foreman at Tres Marias.
"What do you want?" he asked.
Esteban Garcia hesitated for a moment. He could not find the words he had so carefully prepared for months before daring to knock at the door of the patron's house.
Hurry up. I don't have much time, Treva said. Stuttering, Garcia managed to make his plea. He had completed high school in San Lucas and wanted a recommendation to the police academy and a government subsidy to pay for his studies.
Why don't you stay in the country like your father and grandfather? The patron asked him.
Forgive me, señor, but I want to be a policeman, pleaded Esteban Garcia. Treva remembered that he still owed him the reward for betraying Pedro Tercero Garcia, and he decided that this was a good occasion to repay the debt and in the process acquire a useful friend in the police. You never know, he thought. I may need him someday. He sat down at his heavy desk, took out a piece of paper bearing the Senate letterhead, composed the recommendation in the usual terms, and handed it to the young man who stood waiting before him. Here, son. I'm glad you've chosen that profession. If you want to go around armed, you might as well be a policeman. That way you have impunity. I'm going to phone General Hurtado, a friend of mine, to make sure they give you the scholarship. If you need anything, just let me know.
Thank you very much, patron.
Don't mention it, son. I like to help my people out. He said goodbye to him with a friendly pat on the shoulder.
Why did they call you Esteban? He asked him in the doorway.
Because of you, sir, the young man answered, blushing. Treva did not give the matter a second thought. Tenants often used their patron's name for their children. It was a sign of respect. Clara died on Alba's 7th birthday. The first omen of her death was perceptible only to her. She began to make secret preparations to depart. With great discretion, she divided up her clothing among the servants and the followers she always had, keeping only what she absolutely needed. She put her papers in order and salvaged her notebooks that bore witness to life from the hidden corners of the house. She tied them up with colored ribbons, arranging them according to events and not in chronological order, for the one thing she had forgotten to record was the dates. And in her final haste, she decided that she could not waste time looking them up. When she was searching for the notebooks, the jewels began to appear in shoeboxes, in stocking wrappers, and on the bottom shelves of wardrobes, where she had kept them ever since the days when her husband gave them to her, hoping to win her love. She placed them in an old woolen sock, fastened it with a safety pin, and handed them to Blanca.
Put this away, darling. Someday they may be good for something besides masquerades, she said.
Blanca discussed the matter with Jaime, and he began to keep an eye on his mother. He noticed that she was leading an apparently normal life, but that she barely ate, sustaining herself with milk and a few spoonfuls of honey. Nor did she sleep very much. She spent the night writing or wandering through the house. She seemed to be detaching herself from the world, growing ever lighter, more transparent, more winged.
One of these days she's going to fly away, Jaime said, worried.
Suddenly, she began to suffocate. She felt the gallop of a wild horse in her chest and the anxiety of a rider rushing headlong into the wind. She said it was her asthma, but Alba noticed that she no longer rang the little silver bell, so she would come and cure her with prolonged hugs. One morning, she saw her grandmother opening the bird cages with inexplicable joy. Clara wrote small cards to each of her loved ones, of whom there were many, and secretly placed them in a box beneath her bed. The next morning, she did not get up, and when the maid brought in the breakfast tray, she refused to have her open the curtains. She had begun to take leave, even of the light, to enter slowly into darkness. When he heard about this, Jaime went to see her. He insisted on examining her. He found nothing abnormal in her appearance, but he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that she was going to die. He left her room with a broad, hypocritical smile, and once he was out of his mother's field of vision, he had to lean against a wall,
because his legs were giving out. He told no one in the house. He called a specialist from the School of Medicine, who appeared that very day in the Trueba home. After seeing Clara, he confirmed Jaime's diagnosis. They assembled the whole family in the drawing room and, without much ado, announced that she would not live more than 2 or 3 weeks and that the only thing to be done was to sit with her so that she would die happy. "I think she's decided to die, and science has no cure for that," said Jaime. Esteban Trueba grabbed his son by the collar and was on the verge of choking him. He pushed the specialist out the door and smashed all the lamps and china in the room. Finally, he fell to his knees, moaning like a newborn baby. Just at that moment, Alba entered the room and saw her grandfather reduced to her own height. She went up to him and stared him in the eyes, and when she saw his tears, she threw her arms around him. It was the old man's weeping that told her what the matter was. She was the only one in the family who did not lose her serenity, thanks to her training in surmounting pain and the fact that her grandmother had often explained to her the circumstances and rituals of death.
"Just as when we come into the world, when we die, we are afraid of the unknown. But the fear is something from within us that has nothing to do with reality. Dying is like being born, just a change," Clara had said.
She added that if she could easily communicate with those from the hereafter, she was absolutely convinced that afterward she would be able to do the same with those of the here and now. Thus, instead of whimpering when the time came, she hoped Alba would be calm, because in her case, death would not be a separation, but a way of being more united. Alba understood perfectly. Soon afterward, Clara seemed to enter a gentle sleep. Only the visible effort to take air into her lungs showed that she was alive. Still, asphyxiation did not seem to cause her undue anxiety now that she was not fighting for her life. Her granddaughter remained at her side the entire time. They had to improvise a bed for Alba on the floor because she refused to leave the room, and when they tried to take her out, she had her first tantrum. She insisted that her grandmother was aware of everything and that she needed her. And this was true. Shortly before the end, Clara regained consciousness and was able to speak calmly. The first thing she noticed was Alba's hand in hers.
"I'm going to die, aren't I, darling?" she asked.
"Yes, grandmother. But it doesn't matter because I'm here with you," the child replied.
"That's good. Take out the box of cards that's under the bed and hang them out, because I wouldn't have time to say goodbye to everyone."
Clara closed her eyes, breathed a contented sigh, and left for the other world without looking back. Gathered around her were all her family. Jaime and Blanca, emaciated from the sleepless nights, Nicolás murmuring Sanskrit prayers, Esteban, with his mouth and fists clenched tightly, infinitely furious and desolate, and little Alba, the only one who remained serene. There were also the servants, the Mora sisters, a couple of wretchedly poor artists who had survived in the house over the past few months, and a priest who had arrived at the summons of the cook. But he had nothing to do because Trueba forbade him to disturb the dying woman with last-minute confessions or sprinklings of holy water. Jaime leaned over the body, looking for some imperceptible heartbeat, but there was none.
"Mama's gone," he said, sobbing.
10. The Epoch of Decline. I can't talk about it, but I'll try to write it. It's been 20 years, and for a long time my grief was unabating. I thought I would never get over it, but now that I'm almost 90, I understand what she meant when she promised us she'd always keep in touch. Before, I used to walk around as if I were lost, looking for her everywhere. Every night when I got into bed, I used to imagine she was lying there beside me, the way she did when she had all her teeth and still loved me. I would turn out the light and close my eyes, and in the silence of my bedroom, I tried to summon up her image. I called her when I was awake, and they say I did so in my sleep as well. The night she died, I locked myself in the room with her. After all those years without speaking, we spent her final hours lying side by side in the sailboat of the gentle blue silk sea, as she liked to call her bed. And I took the opportunity to tell her everything I couldn't say before, everything I'd been holding in since that terrible night when I beat her. I took off her nightgown and examined her meticulously for any trace of illness that might have justified her death. When I found none, I realized that she had simply fulfilled her mission in this life, and that she had escaped to another dimension where her spirit, finally free of its material burden, would be more at home. There was no deformity or anything terrible about her death. I examined her at length, because it had been years since I'd had a chance to look at her the way I wanted to, and in that time my wife had changed, as we all do, with the passage of time. She looked as beautiful as ever. She had lost weight, and at first I thought she might have grown because she looked taller, but then I realized it was just an optical illusion, the effect of my own shrinking. Before, I had always felt like a giant next to her, but when I lay down next to her on the bed, I saw that we were almost the same size. Her mane of rebellious curls, which had charmed me so when we were married, was muted by a few white strands that lit her sleeping face. She was very pale, with shadows around her eyes. I noticed, for the first time, tiny, delicate wrinkles at the corners of her lips and on her forehead. She looked like a child. She was cold, but she was the same sweet woman as ever. I spoke to her gently, caressed her, and slept a while when weariness overcame my grief. The irremediable fact of her death did nothing to alter our reunion. We were finally reconciled. At daybreak, I began to fix her up so she would look good when the others came in. I dressed her in the white tunic she kept in her wardrobe. I was surprised to see how little clothing she had. I'd always thought of her as an elegant woman. I found some woolen socks and put them on her so her feet wouldn't be cold, because she was always easily chilled. Then I brushed her hair, intending to put it up in the bun she always wore. But when I pulled the bristles through her hair, the curls floated up around her face, and I decided she looked prettier that way. I looked for her jewels, but couldn't find them anywhere. So I took off the gold ring I had worn since the day we were engaged and slipped it on her finger to replace the one she removed when she cut me out of her life. I arranged the pillows, straightened the bed, put a few drops of cologne on her neck, and opened the window to let the morning in. When everything was ready, I opened the door and let my children and granddaughter say goodbye to her. They saw Clara smiling, clean and beautiful, just as she always had been. I had shrunk 4 inches, my shoes were swimming on me, and my hair had gone completely white, but I wasn't crying anymore. "You can bury her now," I said. "And while you're at it," I added, "you might as well bury my mother-in-law's head. It's been gathering dust down in the basement since God knows when." I left the room, dragging my feet to keep my shoes from falling off. This was how my granddaughter learned that the contents of the pigskin hat box she used for celebrating black masses and decorating her playhouse in the basement was the head of her great-grandmother, Nivea, which had remained unburied for years, first to avoid scandal, and later because in the turmoil of this house we simply forgot about it. We buried it in the strictest privacy so as not to set people talking. After the employees of the funeral home had finished placing Clara in her coffin and turning the drawing room into a proper funeral chapel by hanging it with black and setting up white candles and an improvised altar on the grand piano, Jaime and Nicolás laid their grandmother's head, by then nothing more than a yellow toy with an expression of sheer terror, in the coffin beside her favorite daughter. Clara's funeral was an event. Even I could not explain where all those people appeared from to mourn my wife. I hadn't realized she knew everyone. Interminable lines of people streamed by to shake my hand. Cars blocked all the cemetery gates, and a hodgepodge of delegations, poor people, students, labor unionists, nuns, mongoloid children, bohemians, and spiritualists, came to pay her their respects. Almost all the tenants from Tres Marias made the trip by bus or train, some for the first time in their lives, to say goodbye to her. In the crowd I caught a glimpse of Pedro Segundo Garcia, whom I hadn't seen in many years. I went to greet him, but he ignored my wave. His head bowed. He walked up to Clara's grave and threw a spray of half-withered wildflowers on it that looked as if they had been stolen from some garden. He was weeping. Alba went to the funeral. Holding on to my hand, she watched the coffin being lowered into the earth in the provisional spot we had obtained. She listened to speeches extolling virtues her grandmother never had, and when she returned to the house, she ran to lock herself in the basement, where she waited for Clara's spirit to communicate with her, just as Clara had promised. I found her there, smiling in her sleep, stretched out on the moth-eaten remnants of old Barrabás. That night I couldn't sleep. The two loves of my life, Rosa of the green hair and Clara the clairvoyant, the two sisters I adored, merged into one. At dawn I decided that if I hadn't been able to have them while I was alive, at least they would accompany me in death. I took a few sheets of paper from my desk and sat down to design the most fitting, most luxurious mausoleum in the world. It would be of salmon-colored Italian marble, with statues made of the same material showing Rosa and Clara with angel wings, because they were, and always would be, angels. One day, I will lie between them there. I wanted to die as soon as possible, because life without my wife had lost all meaning for me. I didn't know that I still had a lot to do in this world. Fortunately, Clara has returned, or perhaps she never left. I sometimes think that old age has affected my mind, and that you can't just ignore the fact that I buried her 20 years ago. I suspect I'm seeing things like a crazy old man. But those doubts melt away when I see her pass me in the halls or hear her laughing on the terrace. I know she's with me. I know she's forgiven my violent behavior and that she's closer to me now than she ever was before. She's still alive and she's with me. Clara, the clearest.
Clara's death completely transformed life in the big house on the corner. Gone with her were the spirits and the guests, as well as that luminous gaiety that had always been present because she did not believe that the world was a valve of tears, but rather a joke that God had played, and that it was idiotic to take it seriously if he himself never had. Alba noticed the decline from the very first days. She saw it advancing slowly, but inexorably. She noticed it before anyone else, in the flowers wilting in their vases, saturating the air with a sickening odor that lingered while they dried up, lost their leaves, and fell apart, leaving only the musty stalks, which no one bothered to clean up until much later. Alba stopped cutting flowers to decorate the house. Then the plants died, because no one remembered to water them or talk to them as Clara had done. The cats crept away, disappearing just as they had arrived, or been born in the cracks and crevices of the roof. Esteban Trueba dressed all in black and in a single night passed from his healthy middle years to a shrunken, stuttering old age, which, however, did nothing to curb his anger. He wore strict mourning attire for the rest of his life, even long after it had gone out of fashion and no one used it except the poor, who wore a black band around their sleeves. Under his shirt and close to his chest, he wore a tiny suede bag that hung from a fine gold chain. In it were his wife's false teeth, which he treated as a token of good luck and expiation. Everybody in the family sensed that without Clara, all reason for staying together had been lost. They had almost nothing to say to each other. Treba realized that the only thing keeping him at home was the presence of his granddaughter. Over the course of the next few years, the house changed into a ruin. No one tended the garden, either to water it or to weed it, until it was swallowed up by oblivion, birds, and wild grasses. The blind statues and the singing fountains filled with dry leaves, bird droppings, and moss. The broken, dirty arbors served as a refuge for wild animals and a garbage dump for the neighbors. The whole garden became a thick underbrush, like an abandoned town, through which one could scarcely walk without slashing a path with a machete. The topiaries that had once been pruned with aspirations toward the Baroque finished in a hopeless, tortured state, besieged by snails and disease. Inside the house, the curtains slowly came unmoored from their rings and hung like the petticoats of an old woman, dusty and faded. Pieces of furniture, trampled on by Alba, who used them to build her houses and trenches, turned into corpses with exposed springs, and the huge tapestry in the drawing room lost the dauntless beauty of its bucolic Versailles setting to become the dartboard of Nicolas and his niece. The kitchen was covered with soot and grease and full of empty cans and piles of newspaper. No longer did it produce platters of roast pork and aromatic dishes as it had before. The inhabitants of the house resigned themselves to eating chickpeas and rice pudding almost every day, for no one had the courage to face the procession of wart-faced, ill-tempered, and despotic cooks who succeeded each other in that kingdom of abused and blackened saucepans. The earthquakes, the door slammings, and Esteban Treva's cane had opened cracks in the walls and splintered the doors, and the Venetian blinds had slipped from their hinges. No one took the initiative to repair them. The taps began to leak, the pipes to sweat, the roof tiles to crack, and green stains to spread across the walls. Only Clara's blue silk-covered room remained intact. Within its walls were the blonde wood furniture, two white cotton dresses, the empty canary cage, the basket with her unfinished knitting, her decks of magic cards, her three-legged table, and the stacks of notebooks in which she had recorded 50 years of life, and which much later, in the solitude of the empty house and the silence of the dead and disappeared, I put in order and read, completely mesmerized, so I could construct this story. Jaime and Nicolas lost what little interest they had in the family and showed no compassion for their father, who in his loneliness tried in vain to build a friendship with them that would fill the void left by a lifetime of bad relationships. They lived in the house because they had nowhere more suitable to eat and sleep. But they came and went like indifferent shadows, never stopping to notice the destruction. Jaime practiced his profession with the vocation of a true apostle, with the same tenacity his father had brought to the task of lifting Tres Marias out of ruin and making his fortune. He spent his strength working in the clinic and treating the poor without charge in his spare time.
"You're a hopeless loser, son," Treba would say, sighing. "You have no sense of reality. You've never taken stock of how the world really is. You put your faith in utopian values that don't even exist."
"Helping one's neighbor is a value that exists."
"No. Charity, like socialism, is an invention of the weak to exploit the strong and bring them to their knees."
"I don't believe in your theory of the weak and the strong," Jaime replied.
"That's the way it is in nature. We live in a jungle."
"Yes, because the people who make up the rules think like you. But it won't always be that way."
"Oh, yes, it will. Because we always win. We know how to move around in the world and how to use power. Listen to me, son. Pull yourself together and open your own clinic. I'll help you. But cut out your socialist nonsense." Esteban Trueba thundered, with no results. After Amanda disappeared from his life, Nicolás seemed to find